Welcome to the Bioethics Podcast, a project of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity at Trinity International University. I'm Matthew Epinette, Executive Director of the Center. In this episode of the podcast, we try something new and different. I sit down with our research analyst and research scholar for a discussion of some of the current bioethics issues in the news. First, though, in the previous episode of the podcast, I announced that our call for proposals for presentations at our 2024 conference is open. That call remains open as we have extended the deadline to December 18. We know this is a busy time of year, particularly for those in the academic world. So while we've received many terrific proposals, we want to be sure that everyone who wants to submit a proposal has the opportunity. So we invite all who are interested to submit abstracts of papers that address questions associated with our conference theme, the future of health, faith, ethics, and our medtech world, or that engage more broadly with other foundational and emerging bioethical issues raised at the intersections of medicine, science, technology, and our common humanity. For more information, see the submission guidelines on our website. Simply visit cbhd.org. Hover your mouse over the conference in the menu at the top of the page and select Call for Proposals. Also, help spread the word to others in your circle of influence. Perhaps someone you know has a great idea for a paper that just needs a little encouragement. Again, proposals are due December 18, 2023. And now a discussion of bioethics issues in the news. I'm joined for this conversation by CBHD research scholar Anna Vollema and CBHD research analyst Heather Zeiger. We chat about artificial intelligence, CAR T therapy, medical debt, and ways churches and individuals might care well for those in their congregations and communities who are going through a time of illness.
I guess I'll just start by asking you, Heather, what have you noticed, what's really stood out to you over the past couple of weeks at bioethics.com?
Yeah, thanks. So a lot of people have been talking about the 1 year anniversary of ChatGPT. So believe it or not, ChatGPT launched for the public a year ago. Of course, all of the celebratory 1 year of ChatGPT was a little overshadowed with the whole OpenAI fiasco, where the board ended up firing the CEO and co-founder, Sam Altman. He went to work for Microsoft, which turns out is a funder for OpenAI's nonprofit arm. So he worked there for maybe a day, or was hired by them for about a day. But then 500 of the employees at OpenAI, so OpenAI is one of those companies, has about 700 employees. 500 of the employees signed some petitions saying that they would leave if the board didn't hire back Sam Altman. So the dissenting board members ended up stepping down. OpenAI rehired Altman. And so then that brought up a lot of reflections about AI and ChatGPT, because two of those board members were women, and in the field of AI and data, large language models, and in the data collection area, there's not a lot of women represented there, except for in safety and ethics. So that brought up some questions about the gender skew, how that area of technology is gender skewed. And it also brought up some reflections on what ChatGPT has really been good for, or where it's been harmful, and how it's affected certain industries.
Yeah, really interesting stuff. And it's just kind of everywhere now. This in a single year, it's amazing how we're now hearing so much more about these large language models, that are proliferating everywhere, as it seems. Several different companies have now released them. And OpenAI, I think, has gotten their share of the attention over the whole firing and rehiring that you mentioned. What other issues are there around ChatGPT? Are there some underlying things going on that are raising ethical concerns as well?
Yeah, well, one that I think all of us that are writers and content creators are probably interested in is, who actually has the right to use this data that these large language models use, or that they acquire to then train the algorithms? So the way ChatGPT works is they scour the internet and use all of the text and everything on the internet, both public domain and not public domain, including things that are behind paywall for most people, and use it to train their chatbots. So there is a lawsuit coming, or I believe the lawsuit's going on now, with some pretty high profile authors who are saying, I never gave you permission to use my work to train your bots. So you need to, I don't know, find your own books to train your bots. So we're going to see how that works out, because the whole premise behind these large language models is having a ton of data. So that's one of the things that I find interesting.
Yeah. So we use the term intelligent as in artificial intelligence. But at the same time, I hear a lot about this hallucination thing where they're just making stuff up. So how do we think about these algorithms being intelligent or unintelligent, and kind of what do we do with these hallucinations, or where do they come from?
Yeah, so that's the kind of thing where you have the philosopher types like Anna here, who can maybe talk about what is consciousness and what's intelligence. And then you have kind of the data scientists that are saying, well, look, we know that they don't have intelligence like human beings do, because these algorithms are not able to discern something that's obviously not true versus something that is true. So they're scouring. So it's scouring the internet, acquiring it, or well, it's being fed data from the internet. And sometimes that data is incorrect. Now, we are actually pretty good at figuring that out. I know sometimes you would think based on the media we're not, but we are actually pretty good at figuring out when something is just silly versus something that actually is meaningful. The algorithms have to be trained on that, and sometimes their output is just something that's completely fabricated. So that's why they call it hallucinating.
Yeah, I was just reading an article the other day, and it was talking about one of the differences between the results you get from one of these large language models and the results you get from a traditional, it seems strange to me to say it, but in quote unquote old fashioned Google search, is that ChatGPT and the other AI models, they're only giving you one answer. And so you tend to think, well, this must be the answer. Whereas with Google, you get pages of results. And so you can kind of sort through it. And that gives your mind this automatic clue that none of these is for certain the right thing. And so I need to make some judgments here. But with AI, since you only get one answer, your mind can immediately go to, well, this must be the right answer. There's nothing here I have to sort through. So it was really just kind of a warning in the article to be a little bit, maybe more, if not skeptical, to do a little bit more critical thinking about the answers that you're getting sometimes from these.
Yeah, and I also think it brings up interesting questions around what actually is intelligence. I mean, like you're talking about, Heather, but not even just necessarily questions of consciousness, but I think we're increasingly thinking of intelligence as much more than a sheer ability to process and synthesize information. Obviously, I mean, I remember watching a documentary that was exploring the differences between creative genius versus like math and science genius. And what does it mean that a artificial intelligence obviously might have this cognitive ability to recollect information and spit it out, but is completely unshaped by art and beauty, right? What about a lack of social intelligence? I mean, this brings to the fore the question of wisdom. I mean, I feel like this is something I struggle with as someone in a PhD program where I'm constantly being bombarded with lots of information, and the temptation is to just operate out of this narrow understanding of sheer knowledge and not actually have a nuanced understanding of wisdom and how that should be applied in the world. Something I think is cool is in the Hebrew world, they explore or they understand wisdom as the ability to create order in chaos. Is something like artificial intelligence or ChatGPT ever going to be able to operate like that, where they have a complex understanding of social relationships, societal issues and struggles, and they're able to not just spit out information, but apply information in a nuanced, careful, thoughtful way, in a wise way that creates order in society? So I think that there's also multiple level of intelligences, and I think that's a huge thing we're going to be lacking in ChatGPT, artificial intelligence holistically.
Yeah.
So that reminds me of, I'm sorry, Matthew, that reminds me of when a friend of mine wrote about sermons that were written by ChatGPT. And the biggest thing I thought on that was, you know, ChatGPT can't think about its audience. And so that's something that whether a pastor is preaching a sermon or you're giving a talk or teaching a lesson or as writers, whether we know it or not, we're thinking of somebody when we're creating.
Yeah.
And ChatGPT is not necessarily. And so, and you can feel that, though I don't know that you can quantify that, when you take a look at the art that is produced by like DALL-E or some of these other AI-driven image creations, where it's serviceable, but there's a lack there.
So we've been talking about all of this with on the sort of tech side of the med tech world, but I'm wondering, Heather, what your thoughts are about the ethics of AI in healthcare.
Yeah, so to piggyback off of our discussion of intelligence, here's a great example from an article that I posted earlier this week. So it turns out they were using an algorithm to look at images. To try to discern early signs of lung damage, I believe from pneumonia. So this sounds like a great way to use an algorithm because, you know, reading images is an art and it requires being able to see details. And so it's easy to skip over some of these details. And there have been other cases where algorithms can help point out something that maybe a radiologist didn't notice. Unfortunately, what they noticed with this pneumonia, this lung study, was that their algorithm, which was a little better than 50-50, like it was right a little more than 50% of the time. It turns out the algorithm wasn't looking at anything medically significant. It was looking at the background. In other words, like when you or I look at an X-ray, I can tell that the frame of the X-ray is insignificant. That has nothing to do with lungs. The algorithm isn't necessarily reading that. It's looking at lighting or background artifacts that have nothing to do with medicine, and yet was able to discern enough of a pattern to recognize, well, this might be positive for pneumonia a little more than 50% of the time. Well, what does that mean? That means that it's meaningless. That means that its discernment is not actually helpful in the medical field. So I think that has some very important implications for how much we trust these algorithms with what they decide. There was another article for United Healthcare got in trouble because they were using an algorithm to determine whenever someone's insurance benefits for rehab were done. So they were not going to provide any more insurance benefits for rehabilitation. And that was based totally on what the algorithm said, which of course, you know that anytime you have rehabs, it's very patient specific. So they got in trouble for this because they weren't even looking at the medical profile. So, and you have no idea what the United Healthcare's algorithm was using to determine these medical benefits for these patients.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that that I've seen over at least the last 6 months is the way in which the tension that exists between what the AI decides and recommends and what the human beings who've been doing the work for a while would see and recommend. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal back in the summer about nurses who felt like they had been either overruled by or at least contradicted by artificial intelligence in terms of what should be done for the patient. And so it seems like the sort of immediate effect of that is that we lack at this point good mechanisms for arbitrating between the clinicians, the healthcare professionals' knowledge and expertise and experience and the artificial intelligence. And I think that is definitely an area where more work needs to be done. How do we decide who we're going to trust on what basis? Some of the nurses, there wasn't even an option for them to push back. They simply had to do what the AI said. In other cases, they could either overrule it independently or by going through a supervisor or something. But I mean, ultimately, when we're talking about patient care, we have to be able to deliver the best patient care possible. And so if there's an arbitration process or a pushback where they have to go through a manager, that needs to be streamlined so that it's not taking forever. And it seems to me, at least this early on with AI and perhaps for all time, that it we shouldn't be in a position where a nurse or other healthcare professional is simply required without question to follow the recommendations of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, I remember that article, Matthew, and you know, there's so many factors that these nurses are taking into consideration that I don't know, I don't even know if they could list all of those factors, because when you've just cared for a patient, for patients enough times, you, I believe this was an issue of trying to discern if someone had sepsis or not. You, right. You start to know what to look for without really knowing consciously what to look for. So I have no idea how anyone would ever be able to program that into an AI.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There's a level of intuition that, that people have to reach after so many months, weeks, years of sitting with patients, being with patients, and seeing the ways in which different bodies react to different things, the way in which different individuals express, not just verbally, but just the way in which their bodies express, this is what's going on with my body, this is the care that I need. Sometimes, you know, it could be more time that they need, it could be a particular drug, whatever it is. But I have to think there are individual nuances that over time, nurses in particular become accustomed to simply knowing without it being a checklist that they're necessarily having to run through to try and figure it out.
You know, I ran into this yesterday, but not in the medical setting. So Google Maps will tell me to take a certain route, and it's traffic time. I live in Dallas, a big city, and technically something is faster taking this one route, but I know that route is annoying because I'm going to have to make a left turn without a, and it's only a stop sign. It's in traffic, no stoplight. And I know where that left turn is, and I don't want to make that left turn, but the, and no one does. But Google Maps does not know that. It's just calculating by its algorithm what is the fastest route. Yeah. And that's a, to me, that's the kind of thing where that's just a knowledge thing. I live in the city. I know that that is a very annoying left turn at rush hour.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't get me started on left turns. So how do we think about this kind of artificial intelligence, these large language models, this sort of whole ball of wax from a Christian perspective?
Yeah, I think actually, as we were kind of just talking, I was thinking about what is our telos? What is our purpose behind the development of AI, ChatGPT, all of these things? And not that we should reduce a discussion of whether we should advance or not advance it on our telos, but just as we're talking about, you know, whether or not nurses should be bound to the decisions of ChatGPT and artificial intelligences. There seems to be some element of wanting it to create maybe more efficiency, control, consistency, a lot of these things. And I think it kind of, in my mind, and I'm curious to hear what you guys think, I wonder if it's operating out of maybe more utilitarian ethics, right? Of what is going to be the best good for the most amount of people? And can we create a system of relationship with technology that operates, not that we have to neglect utilitarian ethics, not that we have to neglect deontological ethics, what we should or should not do. I think that's, even that is problematic in our development of AI, because then the question is, well, who decides what we should or shouldn't do? But getting into the question of virtue ethics, I think that's a, how are we shaped as people who are in right relationship with mankind, with God, with ourselves? And these are larger questions and questions of whether or not we'll allow ChatGPT to control how a nurse operates in a clinical setting. So I don't know. I'm curious to hear you guys' thoughts on that.
Yeah.
I saw an article, and the author's name escapes me, but the title of the article was, "What is the problem that ChatGPT is trying to solve?" And I think that's what Anna is asking. Because is it always better to be more efficient? Is it always better to have an answer to a question, one answer that I guess the goal is by consensus of the information on the internet. I'm not really sure how you arrive at that one answer. And I wonder what kind of person that makes us when, like Anna, what you're saying, what kind of person does it make you when you don't go explore an answer, when you don't practice discernment, when you don't weigh out the two conflicting viewpoints and really wrestle with that, but are just spoon-fed some sort of information without thought?
Yeah, this is one of the things we talk about here on the campus in terms of our teaching and the formative aspect for students of writing their own papers, of doing their own research. Of course, students could use, we're trying to figure out right now where exactly the limits are on using something like OpenAI with a paper. So is it okay for them to use it to generate ideas or to rephrase things or to write their papers entirely? And part of the discussion involves the way in which doing the work of writing a paper, even if it's not entirely well written, helps that person to grow even beyond just the kind of knowledge of this particular class, but to be the kind of person who can communicate clearly, who can think clearly, who can express themselves well. I mean, these are all parts of the education process that aren't necessarily linked one for one to I'm taking a class on, you know, XYZ 101. Now I know a lot more about XYZ. There are these other aspects of, you know, what we like to think of in ethics, at least, as human flourishing. What does it mean to be a fully developed person, to be a person who lives well in the world? I think we're all convicted here on campus that it involves more than just you're able to turn in a good paper, no matter how you went about generating that paper. I've told my students this for a long time, is, you know, I'd rather see your work that you're not that proud of, or that you don't even think is maybe that good, or that you don't think will earn a good grade, but knowing that it's your work, and we can go from there on trying to improve things, work through things, see the way in which maybe things could be improved. And I think similarly in the healthcare setting, I mean, as you were saying, Anna, searching for the answer, exploring the possibilities, doing that differential diagnosis and trying to find out what's really going on here.
Yeah, I've been working on a project on idolatry and technology. And so just digging into building a biblical theology of idolatry has been really interesting, because especially in the prophets, they talk about idolatry as basically you've created this idol by your own hands. It's very clearly deaf, dumb, and mute. And now you're worshiping this very thing that you created that is very obviously deaf, dumb, and mute. And thereby you're becoming deaf, dumb, and mute, right? We become what we worship. And I wonder if a lot of what's happening around artificial intelligence and our thirst for unbridled progression and advancement, or for control, or for consistency, or for whatever it is, if we're creating a system that is by our own hands, it's deaf, dumb, and mute. You know, all these things we're talking about are actually the ChatGPT, artificial intelligence's inability to really be able to hold all of these ethical questions, the humanity, the human dignity of people. And so we're creating this system, and then we are worshiping it and becoming like it. And that is idolatry, ultimately. Yeah. So, yeah. Another issue that we have seen current in our society is the reality of CAR T therapy. Heather, what are you seeing in this? First off, explain to us what is CAR T therapy, and then what are kind of the main ethical questions currently happening in the bioethical world around this issue?
Yeah, so this was in the news recently, so let's just review. So for the longest time, there were three ways to attack cancer. You cut it out, you burn it, or you poison it. So surgery, radiation, or chemotherapy. But in the last few years, I guess the last 10 years, there's something called CAR T therapy. So this is, I can tell you what it means, but it's a bunch of sciencey words. Chimeric antigen receptor is the CAR part, and then T is for the T cells. That's part of your immune system. So this is therapy that actually takes the body's immune cells, its T cells, genetically modifies them so that these T cells will then recognize the cancer cells and attack them. So it's very clever therapy because it's using the body's own cells and it's using the body's own immune system to then attack cancer cells. And so in 2017, CAR T therapy was approved by the FDA for blood cancers. So like leukemia and that kind of cancer. And normally it's kind of a last resort after trying chemotherapy or radiation.
Okay. And so why is it a last resort?
So it's a last resort because it's still very cumbersome. Think about like when you get a stem cell transplant. So it's still very hard on the patient and it's also very new. So we actually don't know some of the long-term effects. And that's why this has been in the news recently is that it turns out in a few people, so understand that there's been thousands of people that have received CAR T therapy, but in a few people, they have developed cancers, cancers in their T cells. So these are the cells that have been modified. And scientists don't know if it's the actual CAR T therapy itself that has caused the cancer or if previous chemotherapy, which does do DNA damage, somehow damaged the DNA and something with the CAR T therapy and the damaged DNA interacts causing cancer of the immune cells. So there's been a few people that have been diagnosed with cancer that is pretty serious and one that has even died. So this is now something that is being investigated.
Interesting. Okay. So many people have it and it's helpful for them, but a few people then are having these issues of new cancers coming on.
That's right.
Very interesting. So what are some of the ethical issues with that? You mentioned that it is relatively new. I'm wondering if that means it's also relatively expensive.
Yeah, so this is one of those therapies that is in the $500,000 range. So, and you know, you see this with some of these rare disease therapies, and this is a new kind of cancer treatment. And so the cost of these therapies has been a big discussion in ethics circles because, you know, this is prohibitive for people, even with insurance. And of course, you're dealing with people who are often in a situation where they have no other choice. And so a lot of politicians, as well as ethicists and nonprofit medical foundations are trying to find ways to deal with this extremely high cost. And just so you know, to keep in mind, there are a couple of reasons for the high cost. It's not just corporate greed, although certainly big pharma plays a part in this, but also research and development is very expensive. So CAR T therapy is something they've been working on for a long time. And a lot of the research and development that goes into it has cost a lot of money. So some of the things that people are looking at to defray some of this high cost is to look at how is research funded and maybe think about funding that research in a different way.
Yeah, I've been doing some research lately on RIP medical debt, which is a nonprofit organization that buys medical debt as if they were a collection agency, and then they simply forgive it. And they're able to do this based on donations. And one of the things that they highlighted was how many of the bankruptcies in America involve medical debt. And you can imagine that someone who's been through other cancer therapies, so chemotherapy and or radiation, and now they're looking at doing this, they may be approaching the limits of their insurance policy, and so would be excluded unless they were able to pay out of pocket or at least pay even more than they had been paying, and then often would be carrying some sort of medical debt. It's very interesting how this whole medical debt system works. Maybe that can be a topic for another discussion, but it's really interesting. But this RIP medical debt is a charity that has done a lot of work at paying off medical debt. In fact, when we had a my wife's uncle recently passed away. And as we were looking in his paperwork, I found a letter from RIP Medical Debt where he had had some debt forgiven through them, which I thought was very interesting.
Well, and Matthew, you know, a lot of times people don't think about the costs beyond the medical costs, you know, because if someone is going through cancer like this, they can't work. They have a caregiver who, you know, can't necessarily work full time, and not to mention bills or just grocery bills, just the normal stuff of life that tends to be more expensive when you have a person who is vulnerable or immune compromised or someone who is unable to work, or you need additional stuff. Like, I know that something I didn't think about till I was a caregiver was going to Walgreens and picking up, you know, bandages and all of these other things that, you know, add up after a while. And that isn't reflected by insurance companies, not necessarily reflected in how much of our GDP goes towards medical costs. And yet that falls on private individuals and private families.
Yeah. And often I think maybe those of us who live in large cities kind of forget this, but often people have to travel in order to see a specialist, or sometimes even just for the kind of chemo treatment that they might need. They might have to travel some distance, sometimes staying overnight. And that just adds to all of these other costs. And of course, insurance doesn't at all apply to any of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I've thought is, and I mentioned this summer in a talk that I gave, is that this could be an opportunity for churches, because certainly there would be people in their communities, if not their congregations, that might be wrestling with some of this medical debt, and to work with an organization like RIP Medical Debt. And some churches have done that. But to help to minister to people in their communities. Because my understanding is that on average, and the way the whole market works, these numbers fluctuate, but on average, every dollar that RIP Medical Debt receives ends up forgiving about $100 in medical debt. And so a church could collect funds, designate part of their annual budget, however they wanted to do it, and very easily minister to some people in their community who might have $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 worth of medical debt or more. But you know, a $5,000 medical debt for some people is just insurmountable. It's not an amount that they'll ever be able to pay back. And so it sets them down a path of really having a long-term hardship financially. And so, but as I say, with this, the way the medical debt market works, it can be forgiven sometimes quite easily.
Yeah. And then also, if churches are a little intimidated by tackling the medical debt thing, especially if you're in a larger city, sometimes you can do other things like offer to give people rides. Or if you are not, or if someone has to travel for treatment, you can transfer your airline miles or things like that. So there's, you know, thinking outside the box, there's a lot of things that you can do. I had a friend, so when we were having to go, to the hospital many times throughout a year, he paid for all of our parking. He worked for the hospital, and so he got free parking. So he gave us vouchers basically for a year. And you don't realize how much that adds up until you start thinking about how often you are paying for parking there. And so that was just one, that was a small thing. But it's nice to be able to go to the hospital where you have other things or other people on your mind and not have to worry about, oh gosh, how much is this hospital visit going to cost me?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's a great idea. Yeah, I really like that.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to ask actually exactly what you were talking about, Matthew. I think what you brought up was excellent. What do we want people who are not in the realm of bioethics to know about this? How should they be a part of the conversation? What do they need to know? And I think what you brought up already about how churches can care for people in this is excellent. Is there anything else you'd say in that realm?
Yeah, I think my other encouragement really would be, and I kind of implicitly mentioned this here, is to look outside the walls of your church. Certainly, there are people in your church who need this kind of help and assistance, but there are people in the larger community. I mean, I know that our church, there's an apartment complex right next to our church. I mean, it would be a really great opportunity for us to minister to people there if we could find out who is going to the hospital on a regular basis and might need, you know, money to pay for meals. I mean, if they're at the hospital all day, they're going to go down to the cafeteria, get something to eat, pay for parking, those kind of things. And then, yeah, even even more if they've encountered some medical debt, something like that. These are all ways that people can help. And then, of course, just the, I mean, it really goes a long way just reaching out to people. If you have people in your congregation, people in your life group that are going through any kind of medical thing where, again, they're spending time in hospitals, they're spending time in nursing homes, or they have someone at home that they're caring for. I know there's one of my former professors is in a rehab home and going through chemotherapy and physical therapy. And his wife posted on their Caring Bridge the other day that it would be great if somebody could just come and sit with him in the mornings, maybe 2 or 3 days a week, so that she could do some things at home, go do the grocery shopping, take care of cleaning things around the house, you know, just the sorts of things you do naturally when you're home. Because she's spending so many hours with him at the rehab center, she's just not able to get those things done at home. And several people have stepped up to help her with that. And it's good for him to have other visitors, to see other people, and not just to, you know, just for it to be just the two of them there, kind of alone all day together every day.
Many thanks to CBHD research scholar Anna Vollema and CBHD research analyst Heather Zeiger for joining me for that discussion. Let us know if you'd like to hear more of this kind of content and if you find it helpful. Or if there are topics you'd like to hear us discuss in a format like this, let us know about that as well. Keep in mind also that the deadline for paper proposals for this summer's conference will be open until December 18. And it does only have to be a proposal. You don't have to write a full paper between now and then. You've been listening to the Bioethics Podcast, a project of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, copyright 2023, all rights reserved. The Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity is a Christian bioethics research center at Trinity International University, exploring the nexus of biomedicine, biotechnology, and our common humanity. Our website, cbhd.org, has a wealth of materials on a wide range of bioethical issues. For more information about the center and to support the work of the center and projects like this podcast, please visit our website, cbhd.org. My name is Matthew Epinette, and I'm the executive director of the center. Thank you for listening to the Bioethics Podcast.